From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Robert Smithson didn't have Utah in mind when he first started thinking about a piece of land art on a salt lake. But the lakes in Bolivia were too distant. Mono Lake in California didn't have the right color. So he came here to build the spiral jetty. It takes some doing to get there, but you'll find the jetty at Roselle Point on the Great Salt Lake. When Smithson had it built in 1970, it was 6,000 tons of basalt rock and gravel that twists into a 1,500-foot coil. Sometimes it's submerged, other times you can walk on it and around it, and some of you have. In fact, it'd be nice to hear from some of you during the show today. We're talking about the spiral jetty today and what Robert Smithson wanted with his sculpture. Join us after the news.
Hi, this is Elaine Clark, one of the producers of Radio West. Our free podcasts are made possible by KUER's generous listeners. If you're a fan, we invite you to put $10 in our tip jar. Text KUER to 85944 to make that donation. Thank you.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about the spiral jetty. It's that iconic piece of sculpture or land art created by Robert Smithson in 1970. It's a 1,500-foot coil of rock that juts out off of Roselle Point on the Great Salt Lake. And it's not easy to get to the jetty. It takes some effort on miles and miles of dirt roads, and it's not always visible. There are times when it's completely submerged, of course. But many of you have made the pilgrimage there. When the British actor Julian Sands was in Utah back in September, it was on his list of things he wanted to see in the United States. He mentioned it to our producer, Elaine Clark, who contacted the Utah filmmaker Skylar Nielsen. And long story short, Sands spent a memorable day at the jetty, or a memorable few hours anyway, both above it in a helicopter and on it, walking among the rocks and the salt. Skylar Nielsen has created a short film of that experience, which we're launching on our companion video website, Video West. We'll tell you more about that as we go along. But the film and Sands' experience got us thinking about the spiral jetty, and so today in the program, we're talking about it. We're hoping to hear from you if you have your own experiences with the spiral jetty. You can call us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. Joining us first on the program is Ann Reynolds, who is an associate professor of art history at the University of Texas in Austin. She's the author of the book Robert Smithson, Learning from New Jersey and Elsewhere. And she's joining us today from a studio in Austin. And Professor Reynolds, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
I guess I wanted to begin before we get into Robert Smithson and what was motivating him and what he was thinking about. Let's talk about your own encounter with the spiral jetty. You've written about how early on you figured in some way maybe it's not necessary to go and see it. Maybe it's too remote. Maybe it's beside the point. But you've come to think a little bit differently. How are you mm-hmm. thinking about it?
Well, I think when I was writing my book and before that my dissertation, it was the work that really most people associate with Smithson. So I think that was a reason, too, that I sort of pushed it away. I wanted to think about other things. But it is so fully documented and filmed and written about that it just seemed to be an idea in the distance that really only manifested because of the way people wrote it about it and photographed it. Right. But I had an opportunity after I finished my book to go there. I'm involved with a program called Land Arts of the American West, which used to be situated here at the University of Texas and then in the University of New Mexico. And it's a program that happens every fall where 10 to 15 students go out into the landscape of the Southwest and visit land art sites and Native American sites and geologically significant sites and industrially significant sites and camp and make work. So I was invited to go to the jetty, and so that was the first time. And I was really stunned by the experience. It was not at all what I had expected, because there is this initial disappointment, at least for me, when you walk out there, because it's much smaller in real life than photographs lead you to believe, and also much more modest, because it is so low to the ground or to the surface of the lake that it's almost imperceptible as you walk along the road toward it. And once that I let go of that, I started to realize how much more sophisticated than I had realized it was in relation to the sighting and the time of day and the climate and how the fact that it was very modest actually made the landscape around come into the fore much more. I had a much deeper appreciation for the thoughtfulness of Robert Smithson in placing it and scaling it and thinking about what would happen to it over time. And I think the other thing, having been to a number of other land art sites, it's incredibly accommodating to what people want to do with it over time. And so I've been many times now, and I just realize it's kind of an open sign. I mean, it's just a very open thing that people can really shape their own experiences around. I don't think you need to know a tremendous amount about it to really have a rich experience at the site, is not the case for other works.
Right. That's part of the appeal, I guess, in some ways, is that I'm trying to imagine how Robert Smithson would think about us, you know, spending an hour talking about it. I mean, I think you get a sense that on some level he just wanted you to go out and experience it. I mean, wasn't that part of the thing that troubled him, is that people over-curated art or over-processed art? He just wanted it to be, it seems.
No, I think he loved talking. So I think, you know, everyone I have talked to, I didn't know him because he died in 1973, long before I was even in college. But everyone will tell you that he would talk endlessly. I mean, he was a brilliant, brilliant, loquacious person. And so I think talking would be something he would want to engage in. So I think it isn't just about a kind of internal experience. It is about conversation and how things provoke more thought and more associations, more deep thinking about things. So I think he would want it to be talked about above all else, frankly.
Yeah. Good. Well, we will. you know, I wanted to get a sense of at what point does Robert Smithson start to think about salt lakes? Like, when does that start coming into the way he's thinking, and where does that start situating itself?
Well, I can't give you a specific date, but I think more importantly it has to do with his interest in crystals.
Yeah.
Which is very early from the time he's a child. I mean, he started out wanting to be a scientist, and he had built this little museum of natural history in his parents' home and collected rocks and crystals and fossils and things and certain other kinds of animal specimens. And so I don't think you could really put a date to that, because crystalline, or what he would call crystalline thinking, kind of is pervasive throughout his entire life. And salt is a crystalline form, so it really is only a matter of time till he's thinking about not just salt water, but the way in which salt water lakes produce these crystals, which the jetty is, of course, now covered with, and this relationship between the geometric and the organic as a kind of life process, which really then salt lakes like that are perfect, perfect environments.
I guess it was the the color potential also that interested him.
Yes.
I mean, he writes about in his own essay black and basalt and purple, you know, from volcanic rock, and yellows and reds and grays. And so clearly color is part of this as well.
Of course it is. And it's something also that a lot of people don't – who know his work well don't think about that much. But that's also extremely important, the relationship between natural color and manufactured color, the plexiglass, the pink plexiglass in another artist, his contemporary, Donald Judd's work, and the pink salt water. I mean, those kind of organic and inorganic, like how they're, again, not opposed to each other, but you can make these weird sci-fi connections between spaceships and salt water.
What did he have in mind in those early days when he writes in his essay, this is interesting, that he wasn't thinking about the Great Salt Lake at all at first. A mono lake was he was thinking about, and then apparently there are some lakes in Bolivia that he was thinking about, but the Great Salt Lake finally came to him as something that was a little bit more convenient than those others, I guess.
Yes. And it's also, to be frank, it's somewhat of a real estate issue. He realized that he had to have some control over the land rights and access, and it was much easier to rent property there to build the piece. So that's also an important factor. And it's also an area he came to know really well through traveling in the Southwest too. But it is a practical problem initially that he needed to solve. But I think it more and more became the perfect aesthetic decision too, because of all the things that are around Salt Lake City, such as the Bingham Copper Mine, which became another obsession of his toward the end of his life, and Wendover, and all these different sites that combine mining, military complexes, and natural formations, and all in one place.
He tried various locations in Utah, but when you read what he's written about finding Roselle Point, you get a sense that he was just completely captivated by it. As soon as he saw that Roselle Point, it had the right colors. I guess it seemed like that it was perfect in some way.
Yeah. Well, I think it's if you look at a map of the lake, it also creates this slight – well, it's called – it creates this little tiny promontory, not like Promontory Point, but it creates this kind of jumping off spot for the spiral itself. But the other thing that I didn't realize till I went there is that the hill behind – is really high enough to create photographs that are just as good as aerial photographs. So it's the sighting actually allows you to create images without renting a helicopter that are quite expansive. So it is the water there, and it is the landscaping of the shore, but it's also the height that you can get to very quickly to make these images. And then another thing are the ruins of the other jetties that are just adjacent there with all the abandoned trucks and oil rigs. And so to be right next to a kind of ruin of various efforts to extract oil from underneath the lake would have been really appealing to him, because there you have this kind of industrial ruin and entropic landscape. And in the film, you can actually see at a certain point when he's moving about in the water, you can see an oil derrick just briefly there. So this idea of it being a man-made thing, a natural thing, linked to earlier failed efforts to extract oil there. It's part of a whole kind of ecosystem that he would have liked, that's both entropic and aesthetic and, you know, ruined and built. And so it's kind of a perfect site.
He considered, if I understand this right, maybe making an island. That was an idea he had. There was an idea that he might make sort of a J figure. I mean, I guess in some ways when he went there, it seems like he wandered around and he tried to let the shape itself come to him because he didn't really have the spiral in mind, at least not at first. Is that right?
That's right. I mean, he certainly – the spiral was an important form for him in his work up till that point. So it was sort of a form that he had used. But according to a number of artists who knew him quite well, it was really Richard Serra who came up with the idea for the spiral, because the design he had before that was actually more geometric. And I also think – if you the person who was the contractor who was working with him, again, there were some practical issues about how to stake out something with hard corners, right, as opposed to staking out something that is a circular shape.
It's interesting. Smithson himself refers to the sketch of James Joyce done by this Romanian sculptor Constantin Brâncusi, which is referred to as a spiral ear. How much of an influence did that image have on him?
I think it's really hard to talk about influence with an artist like this because he is just or privileging one thing over another. He was just somebody who was like an intellectual vacuum cleaner. I mean, he's just pulling stuff in from all kinds of directions, both pedestrian and extremely rarefied, and making connections among all those things. So it's always a kind of this sort of scheme to make as many things be in play as you can possibly make, because he's really after these images that have deep history, that is both related to human history but also to geological history. So, because he also talks in the film about the spiral as mimicking this mythical whirlpool that was believed to be at the center of
the lake.
Lake. So it's this constant layering, and that's another way that even though it seems like he's filling it with meaning, it actually makes it very open, because then other people can come and draw associations because it's such an iconic form.
Smithson writes in his essay about the jetty about the so-called surd state, how the steps of the sculpture descend from logic to this surd state. So maybe you could help me understand that. It transforms from something graphic, something that you can sort of put on a grid, you know, a spiral, to something that, as he puts it in his essay, cannot be expressed by number or rationality. What's he getting at there?
Oh, it's kind of a difficult concept, but it's sort of that space, kind of like prime numbers or these things that are kind of holding everything together, but also empty centers. At the same time, that's the best I can tell you. It's hard to explain in words.
Yeah, I guess he he's the idea of salt, aside from the crystal part. But does he make a connection between that? Because you get a sense of this in his essay between salt and salt lakes as being like the primordial seas. Is that a connection that's important to him?
I think it is, because, like I said, with this expansiveness of the image of the spiral, which he wants to connect to not only James Joyce but to petroglyphs and these mythical ideas, he's really interested in a view of history that is broader and almost unknowable in its longevity, that's beyond human existence. So a kind of geological history that exists way before humans enter the earth. And so to create works that force viewers to think about history in this incredibly through this incredibly long duration that doesn't include them for most of it. So that is part of it there. Thus, using these simple symbols that can be linked to kind of prehistoric or pre-writing, but also are literally made by nature. And spirals are made by nature in various ways. So there's a kind of human agency, but also a kind of inorganic agency in trying to link all of those things together. Again, that's why influence is a tricky thing, because he's using things that belong to all of us.
Right.
You know, it's not like he's inventing them.
Yeah. Ann Reynolds is with us. She's an art historian, author of the book Robert Smithson Learning from New Jersey and Elsewhere. This came from Shelley from Springville today. She said, I made the pilgrimage to the Spiral Jetty with my dad and my twin 9-month-old daughters a few years ago. What struck me was the utter, total silence. The earth was perfectly still, and all I could hear was my own heartbeat. Combined with the symbolic shape of the jetty, it was a spiritual experience, Shelley writes. There is something to say for the adventure factor, too. We passed herds of wild horses, and it tested the suspension of our four-wheel drive. We also asked the writer and naturalist Terry Tempest Williams about whether she had encountered the spiral jetty. And for her, she said, the spiral jetty is deeply symbolic. We spoke with her when she joined us late last month.
The spiral jetty holds a lot of heat for me. And not just the heat of Great Salt Lake that emanates from that place, but when my mother was dying, as she was dying, the spiral jetty was covered with water. Those were the high water years from 1983 to 1987 when she died. But it held a mystery for me, and also an assurance that there was one place on the lake that I could visit that didn't hold the pain of my mother, that somehow, as my mother was dying, the spiral jetty was submerged, and that when it would reemerge, it would hold a new life for me. And so it took me a long time to have enough courage to go out and face my new life without my mother. And my mother died in 1987. I did not make my pilgrimage out to the spiral jetty until, I believe it was 2009. And when I went out to the spiral jetty, I went out with our son, Louis Kakumba, from Rwanda, and we walked it together. And it symbolized life goes on. Life is a spiral, and it is born out of love and art and a vision of the humanities. So I think when Smithson created that spiral, whether it was about entropy, moving inward or outward, I love knowing that at that place at Great Salt Lake, it is the spiral of our own humanity.
That's Terry Tempest Williams. We spoke with her late last month. Again, Ann Reynolds is with us, art historian who's written about Robert Smithson and the Spiral Jetty. But we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're exploring the intriguing piece of land art on the Great Salt Lake, the Spiral Jetty. You've probably seen an image of the 1,500-foot coil of basalt rocks and gravel, but a photo is one thing. Making that pilgrimage over the miles and miles of dirt roads to Roselle Point to really take it in is another one. We're launching a short film by the filmmaker Skylar Nielsen and the folks at Vita Brevis Films today. It's on our Video West website. We'll tell you a little bit more about it, but it got us thinking about Robert Smithson, the man who created this piece of art. Ann Reynolds is with us, art historian, who's written about spiral jetting and about Robert Smithson. She's joining us from Austin. And Kelly Kivland is also with us now, assistant curator for the DIA Art Foundation. They're the owners of the Spiral Jetty. They work in partnership with the Utah Museum of Fine Arts and the Great Salt Lake Institute at Westminster College to maintain it. Kelly Kivland serves as the liaison with Utah partners, and she's joining us from NPR in New York. And Kelly Kivland, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Well, we spoke with Ann Reynolds about her first encounter with Spiral Jetty. You want to tell us about yours? It's an interesting story. It was 2011. You went with Smithson's widow, Nancy.
I did. It was a very special experience. I was I had just started at DIA maybe 6 months before and had made the trip out in October, and I made the trip on the occasion of Nancy's show at the UMFA titled Sightlines. And I also went out there, of course, for what we have now is our annual trip to Spiral Jetty. DIA does that and meets with the partners in Salt Lake City. But my travels to Spiral Jetty were with Nancy Holt and several others that were in town for her show, and also the partners of UMFA and the Great Salt Lake Institute that DIA is, you know, honored to be in relationship with for our Spiral Jetty promotion, as well as keeping the integrity of the artwork and also providing information on the artwork for the local audiences and for the community. But that day that I went out to the Spiral Jetty with Nancy was a beautiful afternoon. It was in October. The weather was just gorgeous. But I, like Anne, had a very similar experience in that I had never been. Of course, it was my first time. And the travel out there, the journey for me was sort of is the beginning of the work. From wherever you sort of set or depart from, and that being for me, Salt Lake City, is really the beginning of your experience and the travel out, and then you do make your way across the highways to the dirt roads. And, you know, many of us make stops along the way. And once you do arrive to the site, and the dust sort of settles and you look out, you are sort of struck by what you think might be a small sculpture in relation to what you were expecting in your 2.5 hour journey. Yeah. But we happened to just be there at one of the most beautiful times I've ever been, where the sun was setting. And I think, or the sun was then, we stayed until the sun was just about setting. But the sun itself and the horizons for me really struck me. And that's something that I wanted to also bring forth, that was something that Smithson really did consider for that site as well and speaks about as well in his essay. And it's the sort of expansiveness of the space, that silence that you had spoken about that came forth from one of your listeners. And then the magnitude of the piece begins to set in. You realize that form is relative in this respect, that all the other attributes of the environment are very much a part of the work, and it really takes you a moment for that to settle in. But once it does, you realize you don't want to leave. Some might, you know, park their car and think, "Oh, this is just a 5 minute experience," and then they find themselves there 2 hours later, 3 hours, 4 hours, the entire day. Some I've heard have even camped out. But that hill behind it is also extremely special. I mean, I think taking the moment to hike up it and look down, you do get a sense of this aerial view that Smithson, it was so important to Smithson as well in terms of the perception of the artwork. And once you take that all in, you leave, and then the entire experience just resonates with you, of course, for a lifetime.
Yeah. It's interesting. Ann Reynolds, I want to bring you back into this conversation, too. You write about, Ann Reynolds, how the impression of the jetty in its place seems to have kind of changed on some level, in the sense that at first Now, when you see it, it just seems to be, and Julian Sands, by the way, the actor, pointed this out to us, that on some level, it seems like it's always been there. It seemed prehistoric mm-hmm. or an even natural formation, like it's so completely at place mm-hmm. in the position. Will you talk about that?
Yeah, and I failed to mention that the first time I went there, we actually camped there for 3 days. Huh. So the fact that you get to sort of watch the light and the weather change, because there can be huge winds there, so which can be quite scary. In fact, it blew down all of our equipment. So you're really in the midst of something quite volatile. But yeah, I think the fact that it is built to last, but also very fragile, because now, of course, a lot of the sandy substance between the rocks has all been washed away. It feels so compliant with the environment and responsive to the environment that it's, instead of, say, a lot of architecture or other built things that seem to be built in as a resistance.
Yeah.
To the environment, because going out there a lot, you see it underwater, you see it completely dry, you see it. It's never disappointing, because it's just that compliancy just makes it more and more and more open,
yeah.
and you see more and more different kinds of things.
Here's an email sent from Joseph, who writes, "I'm an artist myself, and I made the trek to see it several years ago in my car, not realizing just how bad the road was to get there." Joseph writes, "I was more struck by the desolate beauty of the Great Salt Lake than the Spiral Jetty itself." Rick writes, "The Spiral Jetty represents, in my mind, the ability of man, quote-unquote, to be able to reinvent himself in the wilderness." And he says it speaks to the value of the big, wide-open spaces of the Western United States. So again, I think that goes back to Kelly, your point that it's also about the experience of getting there and also about the land around it as opposed to just the sculpture itself. It's all-encompassing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think also this idea that we've been speaking about man and human intervention and things was really important to Smithson, and I'm sure Anne can speak to this as well, but his idea of nature involved man, and that is something that was really important to him in building this structure, this sculpture, rather, with the help of the contractor Bob Phillips, and the idea that we can be a part of nature, and he left this sculpture to nature, so to speak, yeah. But that upon our visits, and that each time, I think this is also part of sort of the mythic nature of Spiral Jetty, is that each and every person will have a different experience that's personal to them. It could be the time of day they visit. It could be if the sculpture's underwater or over water. It could be the weather. It could be very cold. It could be very hot. Who they're with, and so forth. And I think that's what makes this such a different type of work than other artwork. Land art in general does provide that to some degree, but this particular work is it definitely merits a personal experience.
I wanted to ask you, Anne Reynolds, along those lines. So now, and Kelly, I want to hear you on this as well, this idea of, okay, so now this amazing sculpture has been created. Do you protect it? Do you shore it up from time to time? Do you leave it be? I mean, Anne Reynolds, Robert Smithson, the whole idea was to let it do mm-hmm. do what it will do, I guess.
Yeah, but it's a tricky question. It's a tricky thing, because he certainly he made another large-scale earthwork in Emmenhalland that was very unstable and basically disappeared within a week because it was made of sand. And he was very engaged in shoring that up and making it permanent and trying to keep its appearance as close to the original look of the piece. So it's hard to say. I mean, there's kind of two camps of thought around this, and I think it ends up being how people's own experiences have played into the piece. I personally feel that its ebb and flow and its kind of absorption into the landscape is the best testament to the piece itself. But I know lots of people feel otherwise. So,
Well, Kelly, what do you think? I mean, what does it mean to protect this artwork? Because you're not necessarily trying to, quote unquote, preserve it. But then in some ways you, I mean, what does it mean for you?
It's a really interesting question. And there are two camps, I believe, as well as Anne says. It's Dia, who acquired the work in 1999 from Smithson's widow, Nancy Holt, and the estate of Robert Smithson. As owners, so to speak, and stewards of the work, we really view it as a custodianship, so to speak, in that we have these partners that are really important that have evolved over the last few years. But speaking specifically to the idea of preservation, we feel, like Anne, that we don't intervene. It is truly we're taking the writings and the vision of what we've sort of called from Smithson that the entropy or the entropic situations that he was so interested in, the work itself we allow to withstand these climate changes, whether extreme, like right now, I believe the jetty is completely dry very far out into the lake, which I saw sort of the beginning of in my last trip, and now I hear it's even more extreme.
But I just want to say that in the film that Skylar Nielsen and the people at Vita Brevis have created, you see the jetty almost seems to be apart from the lake. It's so dry there right now.
I've heard. And I'll be seeing it soon. The first time I was out there, it was underwater. And it was very cold to sort of walk through at times, too. And for 3 decades, it was underwater. Just after Smithson made it, it was underwater, starting in 72 through 2000s, early 2000s. So we, as the stewards, really feel that the work is as the work was and will be. It really is not to be disturbed. The only things that we had wonderful partners with the state of Utah and the DNR who have done quite a bit to, help protect the site for our visitors. They've made a couple of improvements to the road leading out there. But other than that, the work itself we have left undisturbed, rather let climate and the nature disturb it rather than humans.
Right. Anne Reynolds and Kelly Kivlin, I wanted to get some final thoughts from you both. What's the best way to encounter the spiral jetty? Just go out there and do it, I guess. What do you say, Anne Reynolds, to that question?
I think if you can have a full 24 hours at the site, that's ideal. Yeah. But I know that that's not possible for most people. But that is you really understand. I think the other thing, spending 24 hours there, this whole way in which the design of the jetty as a circumference really allows you to understand it as a platform for viewing 360 the space as you walk around the jetty and are forced to look in every direction, and being able to do that in the morning, in the evening, when it's completely dark, really gives you a sense of, in a profound way, of how integrated it is into the site. So that would be my suggestion. And also, as Kelly mentioned, giving yourself time on the drive from, in my case, the airport, out there, and really allowing yourself to become open to all those different cultural changes as you move farther from the city and off the highway, et cetera. Because it's always about the back and forth for him. It's never just the site itself as a discrete experience.
Kelly, what about you?
Leading off of what Anne just said, actually, I will have that 24-hour experience. I'm going to take that challenge. I'll try to do that my next time. my trips out there have been a few hours. I always suggest at least a few hours, if not longer. But I think the beauty of the work is very much this back and forth, that you should accept the experience you have and take that for what it provides and know that it's there for you to visit again and have another and new experience.
That's Kelly Kivland, who is the assistant curator for the Dia Art Foundation, owners of the Spiral Jetty, joined us from NPR New York. Kelly, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks so much.
And Ann Reynolds, art historian, has written on the artist Robert Smithson. She joined us from the studios in Austin, Texas. Professor Reynolds, thanks to you.
Thank you so much.
Let me read an email from Valerie, who writes, I've been to the Spiral Jetty numerous times as an artist and contemporary art lover and always found it about the journey, peaceful and contemplative. She said more about the surroundings than the actual piece, for her anyway. Valerie writes, the day that we were there, she was with some art students, it was covered in knee-deep white gelatinous foam that giggled with every gust and breeze. She says it was the funniest work of art we have ever seen. We need to take a break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we are talking about the Spiral Jetty. Today on Video West, we are launching a short film by Skylar Nielsen of Vita Brevis Films. We're premiering it on Video West. I'll tell you a little bit about it as we go along. But we want to take a call because it's not every day you get to talk to a brine shrimper on the Great Salt Lake. Jim is joining us. Jim, welcome.
Well, I just have a great story to tell. I have been to the Spiral Jetty many times at many different levels. But 3 years ago, I was able to approach it by boat. It was one of the inversion days, it was super foggy, could barely see anything, so I just putted my boat up to right to the edge. It was at a perfect level. Actually, it was just below the surface, sticking up in a few spots. And of course, there was actual people there. I couldn't believe it in the thick fog. And I got out of my boat, threw the anchor, and started to walk to shore, and I couldn't quite make it because it was just over my boots. And so I, in almost a whisper, I could hear the people talking. I said, how's the view from there? And the woman said, you're ruining my view. So I put my head down and walked back to my boat and disappeared into the fog. So I wonder if that couple's listening today, if maybe they could send me the picture somehow.
Good, all right.
They were taking photos.
We'll see. Jim, thanks a lot. Glad you called. I mentioned how in September the actor Julian Sands had joined us. He wanted to see the Spiral Jetty. He's the one that got us thinking about all of this. The result is that short film that I mentioned from Skylar Nielsen and Vita Brevis Films. But we spoke with Julian Sands last week by phone to ask him about his impression of the Spiral Jetty and also his impression of the film that he's featured in. Here's what he said.
I felt a kind of awe, firstly, at the scale of the jetty. I'd imagined something much smaller. I wasn't prepared for the immensity of its presence in the landscape. I thought it would be more diminutive, and it really exists as a geological feature, not merely as a man-made sculpture. It is of the earth, and that was very thrilling. That was my first reaction.
Now, when you, how did that experience change when you were on the ground with it?
I don't think the experience changed. It developed. What one realized when one was on the ground is the profound majesty of this piece. That yes, it was of man's hand, and yet the fusion of art and earth power had revealed this extraordinary experience, both visually, but physically, geophysically. You felt quite both humbled and empowered walking the jetty. It has this sort of, I think, Smithson's intellectual consideration of what it was he wanted to create led him to something which verges on a on a transporter through other dimensions.
Do you feel touching the stones as you did, because I saw you touching them, one which was shaped like a heart. So there's a tactile experience there as well.
Very much so. And the tactile experience isn't just through touching the stones, these igneous lava rocks, but you feel it through your feet. I mean, there's no question, as you one foot step in front of the other, there is a sensation from the monument which blasts straight into your nervous system. You feel it on your skin too, that the salty air and the slight breeze gives a sort of a different experience of moving through the air because of the location, because of this highly concentrated salt bed. And the different light and the different feeling of space that you have on the Great Salt Lake.
You weren't in Utah long, of course, only stayed a night. But so why was it that the Spiral Jetty was one of the things you had hoped to see anyway?
Well, I knew of the Spiral Jetty, and it's one of those things which was on my U.S. bucket list to see and experience. But when I realized how close it was to where I was performing a celebration of Harold Pinter, but I'd been drawn to it as an idea from photographs I'd seen and from a man called Michael Govan, his account of visiting it recently. He'd said that the lake level was very low and that the sculpture was fully revealed. Michael Govan used to run the Dyer Foundation in New York and now runs the L.A. County Museum in Los Angeles.
Do you think being there, seeing it in the air and then on the ground, do you think you got a sense of what Smithson was getting at in some way?
Well, I hope so. I mean, if he was seeking some sort of metaphysical experience made physical, if he was exploring the very nature of our primordial being, then absolutely. I felt both those things very strongly. And I would defy any visitor not to. And I do, from having read Smithson's preparatory writings, I think those were definitely elements he was seeking to explore. So I did feel a very definite connection to him.
Let me ask you to react to the short film. Is it, properly beautiful, properly surreal, properly metaphysical, in keeping with your experience and with the vision of Smithson, do you think?
I found Skylar Nielsen's short film to be such a beautiful artwork in its own right. It is a record of Smithson's sculpture, but it transcends that or transforms from that into a reactive work of art, which fuses Smithson's imageries and ideas. And we use on the soundtrack the words he wrote in his own intellectual exploration of what he wanted the jetty to be. And we quote some G.K. Chesterton, which he was inspired by too, on the nature of red, the nature of blood. I think it's a very powerful fusion of Smithson's works, Skylar's work, and my own humble presence. I think it works beautifully.
It's Dr. Julian Sands when we spoke with him last week. Skylar Nielsen is actually joining us now, the founder of Vita Brevis Films, production company here in Salt Lake City. We've partnered with Skylar on two other films, including Mars One Way. Skylar, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Doug.
So it's interesting, talking to Kelly earlier on, she said, or maybe it was Anne who said when she first encountered the Spiral Jetty, it seemed like she was disappointed because it seemed small. But other people, you included, you were like, wow, this is big. Explain how what you thought when you first saw it.
Well, I think our perspective of the whole thing was a little bit unique in the sense that we flew in on a helicopter to see it.
Yeah.
And from the air, when we first saw it, it looked so big. But then when we happened to get on the ground and land and you walked up to it, it seemed to shrink. But then we crawled up on the hill to the side and you see the seismic relationship between a human being inside of it and the size of it. And that's when you get a real sense of the expanse and the size of it.
Yeah. I wonder, at what point did you think, what am I going to do with this to make a film? You know, because there's not like a discrete story or narrative here. In some ways, it's just as surreal as the Spiral Jetty is in some way. Were you thinking of it like that?
Well, it kind of goes back to the phone call that we received from Elaine Clark, your producer. She said, well, do you want to go see the Spiral Jetty? Well, of course. And then I asked, well, what's the story here, Elaine? She said, I don't know. So it's kind of one of those great positions to be in, to be given the potential to do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. It's the double-edged sword because you could completely hang yourself or you could do something that might be okay. And so it was more or less our exploration and observation with Mr. Sands seeing it for the first time.
What was it, the thing that he said to you? He said, did I make the final cut or something?
Yeah, well, that was the first thing he said. He's like, well, so we asked if we could use him on air. And he said, well, did I make the cut? And I'm,
are the cut.
Yes, exactly. I said, well, with all due respect, of course you made the cut. I said, without you and your narration there, we wouldn't have a film. So, yes, of course, you made the cut.
Yeah. Say something about the music, finally. We've got about a minute left or so. Because okay. It's also really great, I think.
Yeah, like now the guys, Luke and Jesse at Giant Frame, did a fantastic job. And we kind of gave them the same creative control or gift, which we received as well. And that was just do something. And they said, okay, great. So they asked Josh to send it through with no sound attached. Josh had cut it and then stripped the sound out and sent it back out to them and just said, go nuts.
Yeah.
And so they had complete free rein to do whatever they felt fit with the visual side of things. And I think it's a great relationship of sound and film.
Yeah. That's Skylar Nielsen, founder of Vita Brevis Films. Skylar, thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Doug.
We really appreciate it. We really hope you go and see the film that Skylar has created. Go to videowest.kuer.org. You'll find links and other information on visiting Spiral Jetty, because they should, right, Skylar?
Yeah, of course.
I mean, you know, you grew up here, and this is the first time you encountered it.
Like in Brigham City. Brigham City. Specifically.
Yeah. Go see it. Skylar, thanks. Radio West, a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Mindy Wilson and Ann Burbridge Ream of the Utah Museum of Fine Arts. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. The show produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.